Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and how the best writers risk being strange. I'm talking to David Annandale. One of the reasons I have my Marvel shirt on, which I would normally take off for copyright reasons, is because I feel like I can have a Marvel shirt if I'm talking about Marvel, you know, this Marvel promo, right? They shouldn't get mad at that. But David has done so many things. Although he's best known lately for his work on Warhammer tie-in novels and some Marvel Untold tie-in novels, specifically ones focused on Doctor Doom. And David, this is, you know, I was so excited when you started doing these novels because my favorite Marvel character is Doctor Doom.
He is mine as well. Absolutely my favorite.
So let's just start with just why. Why is Dr. Doom so great?
He's a great gothic hero villain, right? I mean, he's almost a textbook case of that figure transposed to, you know, a couple hundred years later. Though my, you know, my 8 or 9 year old self wouldn't have known that when he first became something of an obsession. The costume is just so damn cool, right? The fact that we never really see his face properly. There's been different variations, but so briefly. But it is so much that mask that is him. There's this. It's amazing how a figure in an illustration can have so much charisma, but he does have it in spades. And there's there's the tragic dimension to him. The fact that he's different from some of the other villains in that there is this. I have to be careful about it. I don't know if nobility is the word that I want to use there, right? But there is a sense of a larger purpose and commitment that goes beyond the megalomania. If that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, he is also, of course, literally nobility in that he's royalty.
Well, yes. Yeah.
But I see what you're saying. Like, there is a level at which he has that great aspect that many villains have, at least many great, you know, comic book villains have, where there's a level at which what he's doing makes sense from his perspective, and you could even argue is right from his perspective. You can see the influence of a historical figure like Dracula and how this character has kind of developed. You know, Dracula, right. A figure who's reviled outside of Wallachia at the time, and inside of Wallachia was perhaps also reviled on some level, but at least, you know, there is a historical case to be made for him being a good ruler in certain respects. And not in other respects, but in certain respects, like there's a level of and Doom similarly, like one of the things that's in the comic is, though, although he's, you know, feared within Latveria, he is very much on a certain level a beloved figure inside of the country.
Yeah.
For some of the same reasons that Dracula would have been historically, that he, you know, reinstated the power of that royalty as an institution, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But that sort of doubleness of like Doom, where his perspective on him is different, you know, in the United States versus inside of Latveria, I think is an interesting thing that kind of eventually makes its way into the comics, and a lot of more modern authors often play off of that kind of doubled point of view.
He does, and you know, one of my favorite moments of Doom in the comics is his encounter with Dracula. Where he is, you know, basically telling Dracula that he wants nothing to do with him. He's, you know, completely disgusted by Dracula's Islamophobia, and simply, you know, what, you know, whatever you're up to, I'm not interested. I think coming back to your point about the duality, that yes, he is literally nobility, but it's a nobility that it's a line that he created from nothing, right? There was an aristocratic line in Latveria, which he has overthrown. And he's coming from, you know, the, from a Romani background, he's one of the oppressed minority that has now seized power. And the, I mean, it, that one of the things I've certainly had fun with in the books is looking at what the remnants of the previous Latverian nobility, what their status is vis-a-vis Doom.
And he also just has that tragic dimension in the sense of well, of
Well, his mother.
his mother, which is of
Yeah.
course where you focus on this in the plot of your first it is the first one, The Harrowing of Doom.
Right.
So could you talk a bit about what this novel is about, and for people who don't know the story of the backstory of Doom, just what exactly that the whole thing with his mother is about?
Well, his mother was fooled by Mephisto, and when she was trying to save her people from King Vladimir, and it wound up in hell, and Doom has been struggling for much of his life to free her, and this has turned into this foredoomed, no pun intended, battle. Once a year, he has to fight Mephisto, one of Mephisto's champions, and he always in, for his mother's soul, and he always loses. And so, in The Harrowing of Doom, he sets out to try to change the rules of the game, to tackle hell on his own terms rather than hell's, and to free his mother that way. And this is happening at the same time as the well, Prince Fortunoff, the who would have been the heir to the throne, is staging another one of his attempts to overthrow Doom. So things get complicated.
I think just going back to that idea of that there's a level of or a sense of nobility to the character. I mean, there is a sort of way in which Doom is a great villain so far as he has on a base level, he has noble goals. He wants to be a good leader of Latveria and he wants to free his mother's soul from hell. But at the same time, like the methods that he's employing to
Yeah.
do this and what it really and like what he's willing to sacrifice, even in terms of his own populace to accomplish these goals of increasing, overall their greatness and his viewpoint of view. Like part of the what makes it so part of his goals is just, almost a like total control, right? In terms of his methods, I suppose. So there's this great like kind of villainous aspect even that's tied in with his sort of more noble goals, I suppose you say. But the other great thing about Doom as a character, I find, is just he has this he's also a tragic character in the sense of having the tragic flaw of,
Yeah.
excessive pride
Right.
in his own abilities, which is almost always his downfall
Yeah.
on some
Yeah.
level.
He's his own worst enemy, over and over again. That he can't, I mean the I mean he's very good at snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Yeah, and
And
there's
it's
this aspect of Doom where I mean you see it not every time in the comics and so on, but there's often this idea in present in a lot of the comics where what to defeat Doom, they almost have to turn him against himself on a certain
Yeah.
level. He's very similar to Thanos in that way. Like only if there's a level at which he defeats himself can he be defeated.
Yeah. No, that's I think that's definitely true. And it is that pride that does it. Or I mean we were talking a bit about this off mic, but it can also be his his in many ways self-imposed rivalry with Reed Richards, and therefore, which can lead to a second guessing of himself, right? Where even if he is doing it right, he'll or has the right idea about something, he'll second guess himself and again defeat himself that way.
Yeah, what David, for people listening, what David's referring to is specifically is we were talking about the comic book series of Doom that came out not too long ago, where Christopher Cantwell was the writer on this run of Doom, and there's an amazing scene in that run where Doom has this like perfect plan, and then Reed Richards makes some offhand comment. And Doom starts, questioning his perfect plan. He gets angry at Richards and like starts questioning his plan. He kind of goes down this rabbit hole of, well, wait a second, did I actually check it all? And of course, he was right in the first place. He should have just gone with his original plan, but he kind of let Richards get into his head, and it all starts to fall apart for him, you know, very quickly, but only because of his own questioning of himself. If he had just stuck with his instincts of, you know, overconfidence, he would have been fine. And so often that, so Cantwell, I think, really perfectly captured that aspect of his doom in a really brilliant, concise scene there. And we were just kind of talking also a little bit about that Cantwell series. I really was admiring that Cantwell run, David, because of a couple of reasons. But I, you know, one is just like any attempt to get Doom working and you know, having his own series that sustains, you know, I'll vote for it. Although that series didn't last as long as I had hoped. But I'm curious to know, like, and how that series maybe had any impact on your thinking about how to approach Doom.
The first issue had an enormous impact. I didn't have the opportunity to read past the first issue before I wrote the first before I was launched into the book, the series. But the first issue came out just around the time that I had pitched writing about Doom to Aconyte. So it all felt kind of, you know, like there was something in the stars, as it were. And the that first issue, which really shows Doom's Latveria, and it does play out the more noble side to him, which we don't see as much in the later parts of the series, which explores the other sides of his character. But there, the fact that he, when confronted with the possible annihilation of Latveria by the outside powers, because he knows he's being blamed for something he didn't do, then his move is to surrender immediately, to save his country. And the fact that he is, when his right-hand woman asks whether he did do the thing that he's accused of, and he's, you know, quite horrified that she would even have to ask that question, that he would have done that thing. So that, and just the glimpses we had of the world there, was absolutely formative in how I was putting together the Doom and the Latveria of the Harrowing of Doom.
You talk a bit more about actually putting it together, and I'd be curious to know a bit more about putting the first novel together, both in terms of one, how you just approached dealing with this character that you know you'd admired for so long, and how do you know, kind of wade into the waters of that without getting overwhelmed. But also, I'm curious to just know you the actual just logistics of how you pitched, you know, working on this Doom book.
Well, the when Aconyte started the Marvel Untold series, and they let the writers who were freelancing for them, okay, we're starting this, and we're looking for pitches on the well, there were different lines, different Marvel lines that they were starting up, and for Marvel Untold, the focus was on villains, and then they listed a bunch of possible villains. And so the moment I saw Dr. Doom's name on that, I mean, I would have paid them to let me write Doom. Like we said at the start, I mean, he is my favorite Marvel character, bar none. So I jumped on that. Now, the nature of the Aconyte novels is that they though they're not linked to the mainline continuity. They're like officially taking place in a parallel universe. It's not the same Earth that of the mainline continuity in the Marvel comics. So that gives us a certain flexibility, right? In that, yeah, there is the challenge of writing about a character who, you know, has, you know, more than half a century of lore, of stories, and who is going to come across differently in some stories than in others, right? It's impossible to have 100% continuity over that stretch of time with that many stories, that many creators, right? There's going to be all sorts of significant variations. So when I approached it, I knew I couldn't possibly draw, have everything linked to every version of Doom. So I focused on the versions of Doom that meant a lot to me. And then because of the nature of the line where if we were writing about, say, a character A, but we wouldn't be able to like start bringing in a whole bunch of superheroes or like other characters, right? So that meant I was, at least at that stage, writing about Doctor Doom and everything that comes with Doom, but I would be creating my own antagonists. And so it made sense to, and it's what I wanted to do anyway, to have him set in Latveria because he's such a contextual villain in a way, right? Like you're saying right from the start, the Doctor Doom that is encountered in the streets of Manhattan is going to be perceived and experienced differently from the Doctor Doom who rules Latveria. So I wanted to, so having him have his adventure in Latveria gave me a lot of elbow room, but also a lot of a chance to build up my take on Latveria based on what I was seeing in what so the comics that I'd read and the ones that that influenced me, but also that gave also, because we're not tied into the continuity, a little bit of flexibility as to when this story would take place, right? So Harrowing of Doom is obviously taking place prior to his mother's soul actually being freed from hell. And so that was the, I guess, one of the like the building blocks that came into place. And then the other comic that I should mention, which has had the greatest influence, and one that was one of my favorites growing up, and that I've continued to bounce off, is it was an issue of Supervillain Team Up. The precise number has now I don't have it at hand, but it was a reprint of two episodes from Tales to Astonish, or Astonishing Tales. I can never think it's Tales to Astonish, where which for a while had a long running Doctor Doom series that took up half the comic. And so this story, now complete in this issue of Supervillain Team Up, was the story of Doctor Doom's struggle against the Red Skull when the Red Skull briefly took over Latveria.
Sure, and then now your second Doom book kind of cycles around Doom against the Red Skull as well.
The third one
Sorry,
does.
the third one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about that book and kind of the premise of that?
So the three books have certainly flowed one from the next with the consequence that, I mean, they can essentially stand on their own, but they are discrete adventures, but they do the ending of the Harrowing of Doom leads into Reign of the Devourer, who's, and the consequences of that lead into some of the events of the Tyrant Skies. But the Tyrant Skies is kind of the my direct sequel to that Supervillain Team Up issue. The events of the Red, what happens when the Red Skull took over are referenced in the Harrowing of Doom, so event, that story is part of the background history in the first book. And the Tyrant Skies is the Red Skull coming back for round two. Well, I mean, they've had more rounds than that, but mounting a very, very massive and concerted assault on Latveria and on Doom. So it's I mean, it's very much at this time it's personal thing. And this was another bit of serendipity because after I had pitched Reign of the Devourer, Andy kind of, and there again, I'd created my own antagonists, these kind of vampire adjacent creatures called the Urvalak. After that had been greenlit by Marvel, they also just mentioned in passing for the third book, if I wanted to use another character such as the Red Skull, that would be great. So that they I just felt like, okay, this is wonderful, all these pieces falling into place, because Doom against the Red Skull, I mean, that's a really rich battle, because I mean, there we have the completely irredeemable villain, right? The one that is absolutely despicable at every level. And so we get I mean, that certainly that turns Doom in very much into the protagonist when we have the struggles between those two.
What's also great about that pairing is, in many ways, the Red Skull is is exactly the kind of person others think Doom is, but and Doom would not want to see himself as. So
Right.
there's almost a noirish kind of level of like concern on the protagonist part, potentially, of like, is this my dark mirror that I'm looking into? Like, I could see that, thematic idea really being implicated in there.
He's also the, I mean, he represents so much of what Doom has, visibly or not to other people, devoted his life to battling, right? So when Doom,
But also sometimes gets blamed for being in a
right,
sort of strange way.
he does. But I mean, to come back to something you said earlier, how he, he honestly believes that he's doing the right thing. I mean, he believes that the world needs saving, and the only way it can be saved is with him in total control, right? Which doesn't work out so well for other people, but that is an honestly held belief. And one of the things that he needs to save the world from is the Red Skull and what he represents, right? Because that ideology was what he and his family, when he was younger, were on the receiving end of, under the previous regime in Latveria.
Yeah, it's a so when you talk about kind of Marvel suggesting this, to what degree does Marvel proper have sort of oversight or connection to Marvel Untold?
Well,
And
the way
what's the
the,
editorship kind of like,
yeah.
what's your interaction look like?
Well, the bulk of the editing happens with my editor with Aconyte. So I mean, first I pitch the story to Aconyte. We go back and forth there. Then once we're that pitch is looking good, then that goes to Marvel, who check it over, make any additional suggestions before greenlighting it. Then the So at that stage, it consists of an outline, essentially. Then I write the book, go through the usual editorial process with it through Aconyte, and then once that's finished, final draft is in, then that goes to Marvel for one more editorial pass through, and the I've certainly had an enormous degree of creative freedom from Marvel. The editorial notes have all been, been very good, but also very, very light. I mean, I think the on the Tyrant Skies, it took me about, it only took me about an hour to go through the edits that we got from Marvel. So I've certainly found it a very congenial relationship. There was some guidance, about, certain things to, I think, very, very helpful ones to watch for, in not just in terms of the characters, but of, like, keeping Doctor Doom right, but in the representations of characters, and and so on. I mean, there was one note that in some ways, the only directive that I got was after the first book, and I was pitching the second one. I received word from Marvel that the two characters that I had created in the first book, to make sure that I did not do anything bad to them, in the subsequent book. And that was the last thing I wanted to do anyway. No, I was I had their best intention, their best interests at heart from the start. So it was actually kind of neat to get that instruction about characters that I had invented. Don't kill them off. Don't do anything terrible to them, which was really nice.
I'm assuming in a book where the exact fitting into a continuity isn't the concern, that their editorship would be primarily interested in, like, is Doom's voice coming through? Is that character the hit right? Is that so? That's sort of the thrust of that.
There would be some of that certainly in at both stages. And I mean, it was very reassuring that there didn't seem to be much course correction needed. In fact, it was a lot of the suggestions would be again just helping certain aspects of the book work even better, bearing in mind this characteristic of Doom. And so both the novel and the presentation of the character, I think, benefited from that. So there was certainly, yes, it was less. I mean, there were some. I mean, it's not like we're ignoring the continuity. All right. It's just there's a little bit of flexibility. So there's something I don't want to go into spoilers about, but there was something that happens in the comics, and I wanted to take things in a different direction. And so I asked, can I do that? Maybe even referencing the fact, quite explicitly making it clear that this is happening in a different parallel universe. And so opening up a little bit of a gap between this Doom and that Doom. And they said yes. Creating, as long as I kept things a little bit ambiguous. But that was something that was I really appreciated. It was quite important to how I wanted the book to come out. And so I'm very grateful that they gave me that latitude.
Now, in terms of your overall publishing history, you kind of, in terms of book publishing, you sort of start with this thriller series that you're doing, independently. You're like, you're publishing with the publisher, but like it's your thriller series, which is, relatively speaking, grounded in like the real world. You later kind of get a horror novel off, sort of with some of the case a connection to that world, where you bring in the supernatural element. You do a lot of work with Warhammer tie-in novels, where Warhammer is very much a science fiction, but it has a real supernatural combination. So you've got this great what I feel like you've got almost the perfect background for Doom, because Doom is so much about science and sorcery together. And so I mean you sort of lean more to the horror genre and more to the supernatural in many respects as a writer, but which is to me again like the kind of more interesting side of Doom to like just personally the kind of more horror tinge. I mean he's literally like dealing with hell in the first book here, and then Reign the Devourer we have these vampiric creatures, never mind how horrific the Red Skull is as a figure. So I'm curious to just know a little bit about your, and I know you also did a PhD where your thesis was on horror. And I'm curious to know just a little bit about your kind of thoughts on the genre of horror and how you kind of bring it in or don't bring it in. Like how far you let yourself go down the horror path when you're dealing with
Yeah.
tie-in material that isn't
Yeah.
necessarily in that genre fully and explicitly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it certainly it does depend a little bit on the individual assignment and the IP and what what I'm supposed to be doing with it, obviously. But yeah, my imagination skews dark. I mean, even the Jen Blalock thrillers, I always thought of them as thrillers with the heart of horror. And so when I wrote Gethsemane Hall, the haunted house novel, but that it has ties to the Blalock universe, it was very consciously with the sense of what the implications were for the Blalock universe of the supernatural events in Gethsemane Hall. And I mean, the risk of oversimplifying things, my contention in my thesis is that horror is not so much a genre as well I described it as a rhizome using the terms of Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari. But if we imagine horror almost as a kind of parasite that can take over all sorts of other genres or be present within them, and when it takes over, or when it is the primary presence, then it can take on the appearance of a genre, and we can often, fairly usefully, if provisionally, refer to it as such. But it exists in all sorts of other forms, right? So, for instance, Tár, the film with Cate Blanchett, has a surprising degree of horror movie aspect to it, right? It's not marketed as a horror film. It doesn't, on the face of it, present itself as a horror film, but boy, does it have strong horror film elements to it, right? And so that's the those are the tendrils of horror reaching in. And so it horror was present in that respect in a quasi subterranean sense in the Blalock books, with Gethsemane Hall making that more overt. In the case of Warhammer 40,000, so that's the science fiction line, or Warhammer Age of Sigmar, the fantasy line. I mean, both of those lines have already very, very strong elements of horror themselves. And one of the initial appeals of Warhammer 40,000, what drew me to that, is the way that it's a kind of one-stop shopping of genre. It's this collision of science fiction and horror and war and fantasy in this glorious mass that has a very distinct coherence and character of its own. But it has this it's this cauldron which you can go in all kinds of different directions depending on what your sensibilities are. And so my books, both for the Warhammer 40,000 line and the Age of Sigmar line, do push towards horror. Even the ones that aren't for the outright Warhammer horror line. And some go to the point that they are essentially horror novels in everything but name. The Damnation of Pythos, for instance, the one of my Horus Heresy novels is effectively a horror novel.
Yeah, that's my favorite of your Warhammer books, and especially because you did even sneak in this really great Deleuzian metaphor to like the structure of what was happening in in the environment. It has all sorts of really subtle things that one can pick up on if they have that kind of background.
Well, one of the lovely things about the Black Library universes is that they lend themselves very well to having reified metaphors in them. It just works so well in that universe, given that so many of the demons and gods are themselves kind of walking symbols. I have certainly that. There's that outlet, that leeway where I can push things often very, very far. In fact, sometimes I've been encouraged, yeah, to take it even further than I had originally intended. And I'm always happy to oblige in that department. With Doom, going back to how we started the conversation, there is that very strong gothic element to him already. Latveria looks like it must be on the border of the of Vesaria or the other European villages and countries of the Universal horror movies of the 1930s and 40s. It's and with and Doom both as a as how he presents visually and his background, there's all of those invitations to horror as well. So that certainly I decided to run with in the Doom books, particularly the first two. I'd say probably more so than the Tyrant Skies, which is maybe a little bit more on the science fictional side of things. Plenty dark still, but and with Reign of the Devourer probably being the most full-on horror novel of the three Doom books.
Now, just to in just practical writerly terms, one of the things that is interesting about you and your career, I think, is just how startlingly productive you've been over the last, little while. I think if I by the same you're by the same author, I counted 33 books, and that was before you put out some other ones. That's just looking at this book. So I'm curious to know. I mean, my contention when people talk about, how man David's just put out book after book. My contention, what I always say is, the worst part is that they're all good. And,
Thank you.
the thing that I can contend is that it's possible in the cup for a couple of reasons, but I think one of the ways that that's possible is because you are using outlines. And I want to know if what your opinion is on that, and how do you use like and may incorporate an outline into your writing workflow there? And what would you advise people
Right.
to do if they want to get more fully into kind of utilizing outlines?
Yeah.
Or is that
So,
just a false front and that's just something they're
no,
doing
it's,
because they asked you to do it?
yeah. Well, I mean, the outlining is a necessary process of tie-in writing, because that, you go through the pitch, you expand the pitch, then you turn the pitch into a full chapter breakdown, and that's just part of the process. So it has to be done. But for that's that for me that isn't a hardship, because that's how I would be writing the book anyway. Now, I mean, I need to preface this, of course, by I mean, on the one hand, I feel like a kind of evangelist for outlines because of the way I came to doing them. But I also know that this doesn't work for everyone, right? That everybody has to find what works for them as a way of writing. There is no one prescriptive way of doing that. And what your creative process, the right creative process for you, is the one that allows you to create. So, having said that, I used to be very resistant to the idea of outlines. I thought I imagined them as being creative straitjackets, and just the idea of doing them just seemed like an awful bit of work. And so the first three, got this right? No, the first four novel length manuscripts that I wrote, I did without the benefit of an outline. And I thought this was the way I wanted to do it. Now, the fourth of those books, the first one that I actually sold, Crownfire, I began to see the error of my ways towards the later stages of the book. It's the first time I'd written a thriller, and I had a lot of characters. I had all these plot threads that I was juggling, and it was becoming more and more difficult to keep everything straight in my head. And when I finally got to the climax of the book, where everything was coming together, I was starting to, I was having to outline things, sort of sketch out the chapters ahead of for myself, so I knew where I was going. So I was already starting that process. Now, when Crownfire went through the editorial process, it wound up losing fully one third of its length. I wound up cutting 50,000 words out of that book, and they had to go. It needed to be cut. Now, some of this is certainly, first time published author process, right? It's part of the learning curve. But for the second Blaylock book, Cornucopia, there I did a full outline, and the putting following the process that Sid Fields, just want to make sure it was Sid Field or Sid Fields? Sid Field.
Sid Field, yeah.
Yeah, Sid Field. What he outlines in the screenwriter's workbook. And it was actually my friend Stephen George who first mentioned that to me, and then my friend Dave Clark. So both fine writers who also drew on them, and they and so this is for screenwriting, but it was easily adaptable to novel writing. So for Cornucopia, I went through the process of the of literal index cards and turning that into an outline. And the editorial process of that book was night and day compared to what I'd done with Crownfire. And it was with the same editor, the same publisher. But Cornucopia did lose 50,000 words in its process. So that was certainly my my road to Damascus moment, and I have never written a novel without a full outline since.
Now let me just put that in perspective for listeners who maybe aren't writers. When David's talking about losing, like cutting, deleting 50,000 words in the manuscript, keep this in mind. My last book was 50,000 words. Like that was the whole book, and that's, 200 page book effectively, that he's talking about, having written and deleted, so literally in that span of time, he could have written another book.
This is in the days when, the editing was done with a physical manuscript and, printing out the new pages and pasting, bits of paper over the corrections. It was, it wasn't just turn on track changes in Microsoft Word back then.
Yeah. The other thing I think people don't really realize is, as you say, like it's a thing that many writers are resistant to. And I'm not saying that either, that every writer has to do it. Yeah. But it is a thing that many writers are resistant to because they see it as somehow getting in the way of spontaneity.
Right.
But what I find, like, I become a real outline evangelist in part because what I do is my kind of catch, or my fail-safe, I suppose you'd call it, on the process is once I've got that outline and I'm moving into the draft, if I am exactly following the outline, I know something is wrong. Like I don't want to not follow it at all, but like if I'm just, doggishly kind of going through the process I had mapped out, I know that there's something kind of I know there's something incorrect there. Like I'm always going to be attentive to, like, attending to that spontaneity and where the story is flowing.
Yeah.
But there's a structure that kind of gives you what's so nice about the outline is not only do you know what you're supposed to be doing on a certain level, it just mentally makes it easier to sit down. But also when you're not feeling it, you still can sit down. You don't have to psych yourself up or do so much prep work just on the day, as they say in film. You can kind of like have that plan and follow it, depart from it if you got a better idea in the moment. But at the same time, like, be on a schedule.
Yeah. I mean, it's a roadmap, and it doesn't mean that it's, that you're not going to take byways or find a different route. And I mean, I've certainly run into things where it's like, who thought this was a good idea? And like, hey, past me, couldn't you have fleshed this out a little bit more? Or I realize that, these chapters now have to combine, or all this stuff doesn't work. I mean, yeah, you're going to make changes, but it is also, like you said, you know where you're going. Right. I mean, I've never run into writer's block, on any novel since I've started outlining, because I always know where what the next chapter is going to be. And so what I do now also is every chapter before I begin it, I do another kind of outline. I just break the chapter down into beats. So I have that guiding me through the next step of the novel.
The other thing you can do, maybe you don't do this, but the other thing you can do is you can write non-linearly. So like you can all of a sudden, if you're stuck on chapter three, you can start writing chapter five. Or if you feel like writing chapter seven, you can jump to that. You know, if you're not feeling it today, but there's an exciting thing coming up, you can jump in there. Like it gives you a flexibility to operate non-linearly, which some people don't like doing, and there's reasons, maybe not to do it. But it really frees you up from getting blocked. And as you say, like it just becomes harder to be blocked on a certain level because, you just have options that you didn't have before. Where if you're just plotting ahead one word after the other, I mean, that's fine and people can make it work. But, once you get stuck, it's nice to have these different routes, these different byways, as you say.
And it's I mean, I do know that. I mean, there are people for whom this doesn't work at all. And I mean, I do remember enjoying a lot of the writing process that I used to do. And I understand people who for whom this is the way to do it, right? That it is very much the writing the book is a process of exploration, that they don't know where it's going to go, and that's the joy. And I mean, that for me, again, that side of things I've never been able to do, because even when I didn't except for like a way back to my early adolescence, but I've almost always known where the book was going to end, and so there was something that I was moving towards. But there are other people for whom it's important that they don't know the ending before they begin, right? That doing so would interfere with the method of exploration. So I get it. And more power to them if this is the right thing for them. It doesn't work for me. I need to know what the ending is going to be. I need to know how I'm going to get there. And so that I have that structure that I can change if I want to, but that is there for me. And I know what the book is going to be. Now, again, for the tie-in work, I have to do it. It's not a choice. But that is very congenial to the way that the writing process works best for me anyway.
Before I let you go, can you tell me what you would advise writers who want to break into tie-in writing, how they would approach that?
Well, I think the usual tips for writing, apply just the care of the craft, read as widely as possible, polish your craft as much as possible. Now, for tie-in fiction, it can be, it depends on the IP as to the trick, of course, is breaking in, right? Now, so that for a lot of them, I wouldn't even know what the best approach is. In the case of Black Library, what they sometimes it's once a year, sometimes it takes it goes for a little bit longer, but they very regularly have open submissions, right? They'll announce they're looking for a certain kinds of stories for a certain anthology or a certain theme. And it is open to whoever wants to send in a story, and that's how I got in. And I've seen some other some people that I knew as fans that I met at Black Library Weekenders who have subsequently moved from fan to freelancer, again through the same process. So it depends on the obviously on the publisher, but there at least there is a periodic opening up to whoever wants to try to write a story. And so write the best story obviously that you can, and make sure that you you know and love the IP that you're trying to break into. But I would say the biggest thing though is to make sure that the craft is there. Your deep background knowledge on something can certainly come in handy afterwards, but what they need to know is that you can write a good story.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me, David. And David's new book is The Tyrant's Skies, which is the one that has Red Skull as the antagonist. So this should be out by the time you hear this. So make sure everyone goes checks that out. But David also has, at least my last count, 35 other books that you can check out as well. Where's the best place to find you and your stuff online, David?
My website at davidannandale.com, and probably socially I'm most active now on Mastodon, where you can find me at David Annandale. I'll have to double check that, and you can have the correct one in the show notes.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for talking to me. Keep up the
Thank
good
you very
work
much.
and keep writing the wrong way.